Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
Today on the show, promoting peace between Israel and Iran amid nuclear threats.
I think everything is possible. You have to work on it. Really, between those two countries, it should be no war. And we really have to say it really out loud.
Decades after the military rule in Brazil, human rights abuses are finally being investigated.
It's necessary that the armed forces open up their archives. Nothing can be done without the details of the barbarism we endured.
And press freedom still under threat in many parts of the world.
We don't have that freedom of expression and that right to receive information, then our ability to hold governments accountable is non-existent.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Raspa in Bonn. Last year was the worst year for cyber activists across the world, with more bloggers and online journalists than ever before being killed by their governments. The methods of governments suppressing press freedom in their countries are often brutal, using a combination of strict laws, technological means, and violence against those who express opinions not wanted by the regime. I talked to Whitney Brown, Amnesty International's Senior Director for International Law, on the implications of lack of press freedom to other human rights.
Freedom of expression is utterly critical. It's how we are able to speak to each other, to organize, to share information, to support each other in solidarity. And if we don't have that freedom of expression and that right to receive information, then our ability to hold governments accountable is non-existent.
What is the state of press freedom across the world today? How would you say, in which countries and regions are the worst affected by laws preventing people from expressing their opinion?
Well, we see different levels of control of press freedom in virtually every region of the world, but I will cite as several that are particularly bad. In Iran, there's been an attempt to particularly shut down people's ability to communicate via the internet, that basically the government is monitoring anybody's actions on the internet, and they have a very draconian law. That's very similar to what China's doing. We all know that China, particularly in the wake of the uprisings in the Middle East, really panicked, and already it already had a history of controlling freedom of expression, but particularly on the internet, it clamped down significantly. And other places, it's more face-to-face violations that we're seeing. We're seeing journalists murdered in places like Sudan, the Philippines, Mexico. So journalists across the board face either the fear of imprisonment or sometimes just physical violence and death.
You just mentioned that online censorship has become very strong, and I think Reporters Without Borders called last year the deadliest in history for online activists. Why is there such a strong move against online activism at the moment, or does it just look like that and there's a lot of stuff against other media as well?
Well, I think that in the last couple of years, governments have become increasingly aware of what a powerful tool the internet is and how people are able to upload information in real time so that it gets out there in a borderless world in a way that you didn't have before the internet. And they realize that people are sharing solidarity information. They're able to organize much more rapidly. So government's response to this has been very much one of trying to control the internet, to make it a geographically controlled space again, and to try to intimidate people who use it.
You mentioned that people can exchange information very quickly via the internet. With more people having access to online capacities, blogs, Facebook, and so on, overall, would you say that the access to the internet has improved the situation for press freedom and other human rights?
Absolutely. It's an incredibly powerful tool. And I think that, much of what we're seeing in terms of the activism that's happening, whether it's the Occupy movement in places like the U.S. or London, or the uprisings that we're seeing in the Middle East and the challenges to the government and other places, activists are using the internet. But the government's also, it's interesting to look at how they're trying to control it. In Cuba, 1 hour on the internet costs about $6, which is about a significant part of most people's monthly pay in Cuba, and you have to register your legal identity so that they know exactly what you did. So that's a different way of controlling people's access to information.
Amnesty International, your own organization, uses media attention to alert a greater public to human rights issues and human rights abuses. What role does the internet play for your own cause?
Well, it's a critically important mechanism for us to get the word out. Interestingly enough, in places that we work, for instance, in sub-Saharan Africa, it is actually the cell phone that's the basis for a lot of our getting our information out, because a lot of the communication there is text-based from cell phones. In other places, it's very much very sophisticated internet platforms, obviously our websites, but other sites that we set up to help disseminate information and encourage activism. So it's a tool that you just can't ignore if you want to reach activists around the world.
And in which countries do you currently see improvement on human rights issues, including press freedom, but also other human rights issues?
We tend to look at where things get worse, not where they get better. The story of Burma's Myanmar is, of course, a very interesting story. And Aung San Suu Kyi was just sworn in as a member of parliament. They went from having her house arrest to having her in parliament is important. On the other hand, what you do have there that is getting much less press is the conflict against the indigenous people in parts of the area. So that's, you know, but I think if we see anything, for instance, from Tunisia and Egypt, it's that change does take time. And while anyone who's a human rights activist like me is very impatient for it to happen as rapidly as possible, I think you need to consolidate the advances that you make. We are able to see change. It doesn't happen in a very linear way, but we do see progress. And the other thing that anyone like me gets is the opportunity to just meet amazing activists who are so courageous and just work so endlessly to promote the rights of the people in their own societies.
Thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
That was Whitney Brown, Amnesty International's Senior Director for International Law, talking about press freedom. And you can find more about press freedom on our web dossier at dw.de/globalization. Iran's nuclear program is arguably the greatest risk to international security at the moment. It's still unknown whether last month's talks between Iran, the United States and other world powers, as well as looming increases in sanctions, will see Iran comply with international demands. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is threatening military action to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon that could create an existential threat to the small nation, which Iranian political leader Mahmoud Ahmadinejad frequently threatens to destroy. Meanwhile, some Israelis are counting on a new weapon to meet the Iranian threat, peacebuilding by direct communication. Vanessa O'Brien has the story.
It began with an ordinary pink and white block letter poster on a Facebook page saying this: "Iranians, we will never bomb your country. We love you." Almost 2 months later, this simple message is going viral on Facebook, as Israelis bombard Iran with a preemptive strike of brotherhood instead of the military action threatened by their government. It's this kind of citizen diplomacy that the poster's creator, graphic designer Ronnie Edry, and other Israelis like him, hope will drag the two countries back from the brink of war.
I'm a dreamer. I think everything is possible. You know, you have to work on it, and yeah, you can make it happen. Because really, between those two countries, it should be no war. And we really have to say it really out loud so more people hears it.
The Israel Loves Iran Facebook site and its sister site, IsraelLovesIran.com, garner more than 1 million visits each week. Viewers from around the world outpour messages of peace, Iranians returning the love to Israelis, Armenians to Turks, and Turks to Syrians. Darius from Iran writes,
"If Iranian people don't say enough that they also love you, it's not because they don't. It's just because of the lack of freedom."
Canadian-Iranian Sonia B. adds,
"I'd like to take my Israeli friends to my hometown in Iran and show them all the beauty my country and its people have to offer. I assure you that we don't hate you and that, in fact, we too love you."
It's everyday people talking to each other across political divides in a way that only today's social media can facilitate. Idri believes putting a human face to the two countries creates a different discourse than the drumbeat of war.
We have these stories of this girl, and she's telling us, when I was a young girl in school, they make me, you know, march on the flag of Israel. They draw it on the floor. So I was raised to hate the flag of Israel and to hate Israel. And then I see your picture on Facebook with your daughter with the flag of Israel. And it changed my mind. And it just changed everything to me. And now I love the flag. And I love your country. And I know that they try to make me hate you, but I don't hate you. And man, it's, you know, it's bringing you to tears. You're reading that and you're like, okay, we've done something.
Idri and his wife, Michal Tamir, live in Tel Aviv and frequently converse online with their new Iranian friends. Despite attempts to block Facebook in Iran, the message of hope and humanity clearly makes it through. And it's not just social media that's attempting to cross borders. Shortwave radio is also ramping up citizen diplomacy between Israelis and Iranians. Veteran host of Israel's international broadcaster Kol Israel's Persian program, Menashe Amir, routes calls via Germany so he can talk on air with Iranians. Amir is an Iranian Jew who immigrated to Israel in 1960 and has been broadcasting into Iran in his native Farsi tongue for 52 years. A lot has changed between Israel and Iran in that time, he says.
Till the revolution, we have been broadcasting programs who represent Israel in social, economic, industry, technology, and political affairs. With the beginning of the revolution in Iran, our responsibility is to broadcast for the Iranians what is going on inside their own country.
Perhaps more importantly, he talks with Iranians and listens to their stories. During the Iran-Iraq war, it was heart-rending tales of bloodshed and loss. Today it's sanctions, Ahmadinejad and Israel.
It's unbelievable when you listen to this program because there is so much critique against the regime in Iran and so much of support and the identification with Israel and Israeli matters.
Kol Israel's Persian program began as a foreign policy gambit by Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. Although it's impossible to gauge the amount of listeners in Iran, Amir estimates that at times millions tune into his program, Your Voice. It's the last shortwave program to survive the National Broadcasting Company's funding cuts. Now more than ever, with Ahmadinejad's regime publicly calling for Israel's destruction, Amir says the people-to-people connection is crucial.
They try to jam us. The Iranian regime has put many controls and limits on internet using and also on the satellite. But we know that there's so many Iranians, they have their old radio set. It enables them to listen to us everywhere.
An estimated 250,000 Iranian Jews live in Israel today. The community still holds close ties to its native Iran and the Jewish community there, says Iranian Jew Mia Yevandenfar. And there are more reasons for friendship than animosity between the two countries.
The natural friends, natural allies, they have many points of common interests. Strategically, in the Arab-majority region, they're both minorities. There's a link between them that's 2,500 years old, between the Jewish people and Iran. And, you know, there's a very strong link between Iran and Israel, which is the Iranian Jewish community.
However, Yevandenfar also lectures in contemporary Iranian politics at the Interdisciplinary Center in Herzliya, Israel, and as such, doesn't hold high hopes for the brotherhood of man triumphing over the self-interest of states.
I don't think leaders in Israel or Iran check how many likes a Facebook page has before they make a decision. I think Israel's leaders should sit at the feet of the people who started the Facebook page Israel Loves Iran and learn from them.
The Iranian nuclear threat dominates the news here in Israel, but on the streets of Jerusalem, not everyone supports the man-to-man approach to peace. Israelis have much to fear from Iran, says 22-year-old mother Yehudit Zabib.
Their government is very bad and we're scared because of them, so it's not fair that we should be nice to them if they're not nice to us.
It's an opinion shared by 28-year-old Michael Katz.
They want to blow us up and we don't want to blow them up and can't stop hatred, right?
Adalia Saloma, a media and diplomacy student who immigrated to Israel from America last year, doesn't believe that citizen diplomacy will change anything politically, but says it's good for Israel.
Anything that gets Israel out there, like, in a positive light is good, I think, for Israel advocacy. And also, if it can get through to the Iranians, if it's not blocked and censored by the government there, that's great to know that, like, people care.
Vanessa O'Brien, DW Jerusalem.
While hippies, counterculture, political movements and the Woodstock Festival influenced a whole generation of people in the United States and Western Europe in the late 1960s and 1970s, Brazil was in the grip of a military dictatorship. Thousands were imprisoned and hundreds killed by the state. And it's only now, more than four decades later, that Brazil prepares to confront the human rights abuses committed back then. A truth commission will investigate what happened during 1964 and 1986, when hundreds of people were killed or disappeared. Milton Brugatti reports.
Late 60s, as a counterculture of protest songs and hippie clothes was sweeping across the United States and Western Europe, Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil were revolutionizing Brazil with Tropicália. While music and art expressed rebellion and an urge for freedom, Brazil was in the grip of a fierce military dictatorship. A coup had ended Brazilian democracy in 1964, and by 68, censorship, assassinations, and human rights abuses were commonplace. Freedom was the stuff of dreams. Musician Caetano Veloso was imprisoned for 2 months in the late 60s because of his music. Many other opponents of the dictatorship were not so lucky. José Luiz Del Royo lost his wife.
Isis Dias de Oliveira.
We got married in 1967. My wife was arrested January 30th, 1972. We only know two things about it. The moment she was arrested, because the neighbors saw it, and that she was later seen in a Navy prison. After that, there was no more news. And what's worse is the state always denied she had been arrested. They kept saying she was alive.
The UN estimates that almost 500 people were killed or disappeared during the Brazilian military rule. Thousands were tortured, exiled, or denied basic human rights. For years, the victims' stories remained untold.
Besides the physical and emotional pain, I was still legally married to my wife, even though I knew she was dead. I only received her death certificate 20 years after she was taken, and even then I couldn't get married or sell any property because I was still officially married, even though I didn't have a wife anymore. I spent 25 years fighting.
José Luiz Del Royo started an archive of the Brazilian workers' movement, preserving documents about human rights violations of the military regime during the 60s and 70s. It's one of the places where people can find out about the atrocities committed during the military rule. Brazilians hope that a truth commission to investigate human rights abuses will shed more light on the crimes of that period. The establishment of the Truth Commission was signed into law by President Dilma Rousseff, who herself was arrested and tortured during the dictatorship. She was one of 50,000 people detained during the regime's rule. Antônio Funari Filho is the president of the Justice and Peace Group of São Paulo's Archdiocese, which represents many of the family and friends of those who were killed or disappeared during the dictatorship.
This is the first step. It was taken rather late, but still, it's the first step. Since the 70s, we have fought for compromise and asked for an end to all the secrecy. Even now, we don't have access to the documentation being held by the army. It's necessary that the armed forces open up their archives. Nothing can be done without the details of the barbarism we endured.
The Truth Commission's work could lead to future accountability for those responsible for killings, torture, forced disappearances, and other human rights abuses. The commission will have the power to summon witnesses and access government documents. But a current law means its findings will not lead to prosecutions. José Luis del Rio and others whose family members were killed believes offenders must pay for their crimes, as has happened in other South American countries.
For us, the families of the disappeared, the Truth Commission has to break with the Brazilian tradition of reconciliation. It's simple. Those responsible for the killings and other human rights abuses have to pay for it. It's not possible for a democracy to function without it. Germany would not be a full democracy if it hadn't broken up the Nazi regime. We want the truth from the Truth Commission. The truth will shock the Brazilian population. The truth will point to justice. Then the Brazilian judicial system will have to do its job.
Experts hope the work of the Truth Commission will have an impact in the development of human rights and end police brutality and cases of torture in Brazilian society today. Milton Bragatti, São Paulo, Brazil.
And our last report today takes us to Scotland, where the band Oi Polloi is engaging in an unusual way of preserving Scottish culture. Oi Polloi is the sole Scottish Gaelic punk band. All their songs are in Gaelic, a language spoken by only around 60,000 people today. Oi Polloi has just released their second full-length LP of original songs completely in Gaelic and are currently touring through Europe. Maria Bakalapoulou met up with the group at a gig in Edinburgh.
Oi Polloi has been around since the early years of punk rock in Scotland in the 1980s. At the spry age of 15, lead singer, songwriter, and only original member in the group, Deke Allen, remembers his first gigs. Too young to play at pubs, Oi Polloi was booked instead to play at special needs homes, fashion shows for 16-year-olds, and at youth clubs for under-10s. It was also an age when he started to become interested in learning the Gaelic language.
I had always wanted to learn Gaelic when I was at school, but unfortunately, back then in the 80s, it wasn't an option, and this is even in the capital city of Scotland, at a so-called good school. It wasn't possible to learn the native language of the country. And it was something I'd become interested in because I played the bagpipes at the time in the school pipe band, and obviously a lot of the names of the tunes are in Gaelic, and a lot of the special fingering movements that you do, the terminology for those is in Gaelic as well. So, you know, our tutor would tell us something and I wouldn't really understand what they were saying, or I wouldn't be able to spell certain things if we ever had to write anything down. And at the same time as well, we'd go hill walking up in the Highlands with the school sometimes. And if you look at a map of a mountainous area in Scotland, most of the mountain names are in Gaelic. And you'd always wonder, what does this mean, or how do we say this? You know, it looks completely incomprehensible. So I thought, oh, it'd be nice to learn this. But it just wasn't even offered as an option.
Speaking Gaelic was frowned upon and discouraged up until the 1970s.
Well, what happened with people who spoke Gaelic in school when this was trying to be kind of stamped out was that you'd be beaten if you spoke Gaelic, if you were heard speaking Gaelic in the playground or something. And some places even had really sort of macabre way of doing things where a human skull would be hung round the neck of some child who was caught speaking Gaelic. But if they told tales on another child who was heard speaking it, then the skull would be passed to them. In some cases, it wasn't a skull, it would be a stick, a Gaelic stick. And at the end of the day, the kid who had the stick or the skull around their neck would be beaten.
Meaning the many in Gaelic, the members of Oi Polloi decided it was time to use their music to bring more attention to the Gaelic language. And so they put out their first Gaelic EP in 1996.
Many times it's presented almost like some kind of museum piece. We want to say, look, you don't have to just sing about, you know, crofting and sheep and your grandfather's old days. It can be, you can sing songs about going down the pub and drinking with your mates or whatever. And it is a living language, and that's the way we want to present it. We also want to try and make it a bit more cool. Dare I say it, sexy.
Outside the show tonight, Gibby from the punk group Overspill explains his indifference to the Gaelic language.
don't understand a word of it. To be honest, Gaelic doesn't really affect me in the 21st century. I don't see the importance of it, the relevance, I should say. Some people go for that whole Scottish kind of thing. It doesn't bother me. Gaelic means nothing to me in the 21st century. No one I know speaks it apart from Deke.
Before each gig, Deke stops by his favorite local bakery to pick up decorative flags on toothpicks, including one of the Union Jack, which he burns on stage with a cigarette lighter at most Oi Polloi shows.
This is our song about how we're not massive fans of the Westminster government or British imperialism. And the sooner the Union disintegrates, the better, in our book. So anyway, but before we play this, we're going to burn the Union Jack. Now, and then we're going to sing this song that basically means Union Jack, away ye go.
Politicians in Scotland, eager to create an independent national identity from England, have made Gaelic key to their political platform. When Oi Polloi sing their Gaelic punk songs in England, the response can be hostile.
That seems to really put some people on the defensive, and they start to say, oh, you're anti-English and so on. You know, we're not anti-English, obviously, and we find that a bit ridiculous, considering that, you know, usually the majority of our set is actually in English anyway. And when we play in England, we're explaining what the songs are about in English and so on. But I think they feel that we're, you know, having a go at them somehow, which is quite interesting because, you know, if anything, it should be the other way around, given what's happened in Scotland.
The Scottish National Party have been trying to push through a referendum to make it an independent country after nearly 300 years of being part of the United Kingdom.
I think it's about time that we've got this referendum at last, and it will be an absolute tragedy if we do not get independence. Now, I don't say that because I feel incredibly proud to be Scottish, but we're all strongly in favour of decentralisation of power. We think it's absolutely crazy that Scotland is run from London. The idea that, you know, people in London know what's best for Scotland.
When Deke is on stage, he encourages everyone in the crowd to sing along, insisting it's not hard to speak in Gaelic.
Since Oi Polloi have started singing in Gaelic, there's definitely a lot more younger people that might be a bit more alternative or involved in kind of activist kind of activities that are learning Gaelic, or Gaelic speakers that are coming to be involved in these kind of circles and using their Gaelic. So I think it's definitely becoming more popular within that kind of movement and circle, yeah.
That was Roddy. He is in his late 20s and is representing a new age interest in Gaelic music, in part because of Oi Polloi. Their music is important to Scotland today, says Shawnee, another fan of the group.
We have a lot on the world of the Second World War, the First World War, and going back 1,000 or more years, but what about today's culture? Who's commenting on that in Gaelic? So Oi Polloi and other bands are actually writing in the medium of Gaelic, new, challenging music and songs.
Punk rock is all about making a statement, and Deke Allen wants to ensure the Gaelic language thrives. For DW, I'm Maria Bakalapolo in Edinburgh, Scotland.
And this report about Scottish punk music wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll tune in again next week at the same time. In the meantime, you can find out more about development and globalization by checking out our website at dw.de/globalization. For today, on behalf of the studio team, I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn saying thanks for listening and goodbye. Let's see the neighbor.
slave poder vo malcomo ma pe